is a story of courage. I had spent 2.5 years and I did not want to say I was failing. I didn't want to say this idea wasn't it. No one has ever solved sizing and I knew that's why I was put on this earth.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Shauna Chu, the founder of Tailor. We hear how bad advice nearly derailed her entire company before she began, before a eureka moment in the shower gave her the idea to disrupt the entire clothing industry. Here's my chat with Shauna. Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning. And I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So, if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking resilience about €1 a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices have been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording in their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod and, to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below and enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass or bring the whole team with you and book a day office. Shauna, welcome to the pod.
I know, I'm so excited. I'm nervous.
We're going to have a good chat. We already had like one of the best intro chats I've had in a long time. So nothing to be nervous about.
Good. I'm so glad to hear.
And it's Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good chat.
Yeah.
I want to start with something unusual.
Oh.
Yeah. What's the worst piece of advice you've ever got?
Don't build for yourself. Don't build a company for yourself. You're not your buyer.
Why is that bad advice?
It was bad advice because if I was to build for myself, I'd build exactly what Tailor is now. And if I wasn't building for myself, I would build the company that I originally started with, which, you know, they were of a similar vein. They were looking at sizing in the fashion industry, but one was focused on e-commerce, whereas what I'm building at Tailor is focused on where the problem starts, and that's at design and production.
When did you get that piece of advice?
I got it when I had this spark of an idea and I'd never started a company before. I didn't know where to go. So I was getting advice from different people and it was like, you're not your buyer. Don't buy for yourself. And when I look back on it now, what they should have said was build what you're going to build, but don't be so, you know, full of it. Like, go out there, speak to people in the industry, make sure that what you're building is what is exactly needed. That's how they should have worded that advice, instead of you're not your customer, don't build for yourself. I'm a literal person. I took it literal.
Yeah, I have a big problem with advice. Like, advice is great and people generally mean well, but they're giving it through their lens.
Absolutely.
They have a lens. The lens might have worked for them, might have worked for them once, might have worked for them 10 times. and everyone is different. They cannot understand your experience or your idea. So advice is great. Get lots of it. Apply 1% of it.
Yeah.
But the problem is, there's, we briefly chatted on the way in, literally in the door, about like there's a lot of people in the startup space who love giving advice.
Yeah.
It's their thing.
You know the saying, paper doesn't refuse ink? It's like the air doesn't. Like you can just keep talking.
LinkedIn doesn't refuse the word startup mentor.
Yeah. And honestly, the amount of times that people were like, let's grab a coffee, tell me any issues that you have. And there was a few people that I was like, yeah, I will grab a coffee with them because they've either done it before.
Exactly.
They've had a successful exit. They get it. Or have they built a company before? Sometimes the ones who fail have the best advice because they've lived it and they felt that pain.
Yeah.
And that was what I ended up seeking out in the end. Those people, I want to hear from them. What was their experience? What's their advice? And they did not give out advice like I had traditionally been given out advice. They told me their story and let me pick out the pieces of advice, which was nice.
And you know what? The best people don't go, never, the words I hate nearly most in the world is, do you know what you should do? I hate that phrase so much. It just boils my blood.
Yeah.
So the polite version. It's just like, and it generally comes to people who don't know what they're talking about, but just love talking about stuff, giving you advice on things.
Yeah.
And the two criteria you've given there are exactly it. People who've built it and done it, or the people who've failed and can give you that advice, because otherwise, what's the point? You just spin your wheels. And the other problem is that a lot of founders fall into that trap of thinking that's work, thinking that they're actually making progress by just getting all this bit of advice.
And the funny thing is that if you read a biography from someone who was highly successful, there's always two or three moments on their journey that made the difference. And those two or three moments are not necessarily hard work. You were in the right place at the right time. You knew a right person, or you were just very lucky. And for the successes, you can't really account for that. You're not going to get good advice from that. Whereas if someone has failed, like they have tried everything, and it's in that failure that they've seen more. That's not to take away from anyone's success, because it's still hard. No matter what happens, it's still hard. But there is those three or four moments and you're like, how did that happen though? How did you get that contract? How did you get that investor? Even for me, how did you get that CTO? It's like, how did that happen? And it is just about being in the right place at the right time sometimes.
And they're the questions I love asking on this pod, because I like going, but what does that mean though? Like, because yeah, I think sometimes as well, and why I love doing this pod and why I love capturing these stories is that, especially as founders go through their story, they forget critical pieces, and they forget that it was that moment on like a Tuesday whereby that was the defining moment. But when you're in it, that's why I like kind of like doing the different stages of companies and different entrepreneurs at different stages, because you get so many different stories.
Yeah.
And everyone has got different like insights at different points. And it's just so interesting to be able to break that down. Because like you said, there's a couple of defining moments in everyone's journey.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that was a defining moment in your journey in a negative way. How did that affect you?
At the time, I was a busy fool. I think deep down inside, I knew that I wasn't on the right journey. I wasn't on the right path for me. And even when I was speaking to people and they were like, yeah, we do have a problem with returns. And I was hearing, they're going to buy. This is amazing. But that wasn't the actual question.
Give me your original idea. Actually, let's frame this, because this is a really interesting part of your story. Give me your original idea and give me what you changed it to then with the questionable advice.
Okay, so our original, the royal hour, because it was just me. My original idea was a company called StyleWrap. And StyleWrap was using 3D depth sensing technology to take a body scan to extract measurements so that we could recommend sizes to online shoppers.
Mm-hmm.
What Taylor is that we use AI to accurately predict how fabric handles during production. so that we get consistent sizing coming out of production. Because you cannot recommend a sizing to online shoppers if it's come out of production wrong in the first place.
Succinct.
Pretty much.
It's I love it because it's one of those obvious problems. Like you go into Massimo Dutti or somewhere and like you can get pick up three different t-shirts, medium, medium, medium. And they fit all completely wildly different.
And on paper, this is what I absolutely love about this. And this is where my experience as a garment tech comes from. You can look on paper at all of those fabric and they're exactly the same. They can be the same weight, the same chemical, fabric composition, the same chemicals used in the dyeing process. They can be absolutely identical apart from the color. And because of the color, that can affect the fabric during production.
No way.
So it can expand or shrink. So you can have technically identical garments. The only difference is the color, and they will have a completely different fit profile.
That is bloody interesting.
So
the color is when you're putting the color into the garment that changes it or what?
Yeah. So when you're dyeing the yarn, it can have an effect. So there is multiple different things that can have an effect. Even the humidity, for example, if there was a thunderstorm and there was extra moisture in the air, when they're actually creating the dye bats, the dyeing process itself, whether it was chemical or all of these things. And then when the garment, like even before that, when the fabric is actually made itself, they put a chemical finisher on it. And even that chemical finisher can react differently based on the types of chemicals or dyes that you've used in the dyeing process. So you will have two bolts of fabric that will be identical apart from the color. But here's the interesting thing. We partnered with a massive fabric mill in Pakistan and we analyzed their data. Now, the data that we got on face value, it was 330 different data points per fabric, plus test data for every single bolt of fabric. And there was one bolt of fabric that we were looking at and we were like, this is amazing. And everyone we'd look at was identical. And what that meant was we'd look at one bolt, just for example, 100%.
What does a bolt mean?
A roll of fabric. Okay. Sorry. Roll of fabric. So we'd have a bolt and it would be 100% cotton, for example. And the dimensional stability of that fabric would be minus 1.3. That means that during the production process or afterwards, when it goes through a wash, it will shrink 1.3%. The next batch that they made 2 days later, exactly the same fabric, same color, same everything. And because the conditions were slightly different, it expands on production 2.1%. So you have a brand and they're making a minimum 4,000. Garments and they're using the two bolts of fabric. It will mean that you'll have different sizes on the exact same garment because it's two different bolts of fabric.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And you compound that across, then they're constantly getting changes.
Yes, exactly. And that is what Taylor is solving. We're getting in there at the second that sizing becomes an issue. And we're looking at all of this data. And we're making those recommended changes to brands.
Okay, so you're going to take in all the data from the brands in real time and the fabric mills and then make sure that it's keeping within parameters. How does it work? Okay.
Yeah. On top of that, we're not going to get too deep, but on top of that, for example, the dress that I'm wearing, the zipper tape could have a chemical from the dye that could react with a chemical that was used in the dyeing of the garment.
Okay.
So if you've ever had, you know, an item where the seam busted open randomly, it wasn't because you had a few much to eat.
The day of my daughter's christening.
Yeah.
I bought a brand new pair of pants, went upstairs, put them on, going to the church in like 15 minutes. Shh. Next thing, I heard was, I zipped them up and they ripped right open.
Yeah. So that can also be because something in the processing of the fabric or the zip was reacting.
Oh, interesting.
And then you have quality issues.
That's fascinating. So you now, and what did you change the idea to that you were trying to get fit? It was like a vision thing. What were you trying to build with bad advice? What was the thing?
So it was recommending sizes to online shoppers.
Okay.
So it was not even fixing the original problem. It was only fixing the returns.
Mm.
But if you think about it, if you can ensure that sizing is consistent and people know their sizing in that brand,
yeah,
you reduce the returns anyway.
Yeah. And you're going B2B now, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So how long did you work at the original idea?
2.5 years.
Oof.
Yeah.
It's chunky.
It was a long time, a long journey. And then COVID happened.
What was happening in those 2 years? What were you doing?
I was a busy fool. I was, like I said, I was talking to brands and not small brands. I mean, I sat down with Nike, like US Nike, head office, and we talked about returns. We talked about sizing. And what I heard in my head was, yeah, like this is something that we're interested in. That's what I heard.
I love that. What I heard in my head.
Yeah.
I love that.
Because it was. I wasn't getting down to it. And
well, you were using your lens. You were using your lens of like, oh,
yeah.
They said it. They said the magic words.
You know when someone says to you, don't ask your parents or your grandmother or you know, your granddad about your company because they'll tell you it's amazing.
Yeah.
People are like that. People don't want to tell you that that's not the main issue.
Or they don't know.
That's not.
And they kind of want the best for you. So they'll go, yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah,
those whereas, words where you're like, cool.
Yeah.
Would you buy it? No. It's a good idea though.
But you'd even get them going, oh yeah, we'd look at it. We'd consider it.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm the type of person where I would much rather someone say, this is.
Yeah. Load of shit. Go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I much rather that because then I know, okay, like we have the answer to the issue. We need to look at something. We need to change it somehow. And
so for those 2 years, you were just trying to get customers. You're trying to find a product to sell to them or what were you doing?
Yeah. So I was kind of defining it and I had slightly pivoted, you know, different ways. So because of my background as a garment technologist, I was like, okay, how do we refine this down? Instead of using 3D depth sensing cameras, which are not really quite there yet. I mean, you'll see some people saying, oh, we're down to a centimeter or an inch. In clothing industry, that's huge. That can be a massive difference.
Yeah, an inch is massive, like in fairness.
Yeah, but even centimeters. Like a centimeter can be massive. Like it does make the difference. And I knew that the tech just wasn't quite there. And I was like, what can I do? And I was like, using the tech pack information. But you're still not getting to the problem of it's not coming out of production consistently. Mm. If the fabric is making changes and you can see that changing before your eyes when the seam is being sewn. I mean, on the back of a pair of jeans, your back pocket, that can drastically affect the fit. Because if the fabric is stretchy, it's not going to stretch underneath a sewn pocket.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So all of these things you need to take into account. So even though I had been looking at it with my garment tech lens and saying, we'll use the tech packs, we'll use the measurement charts, we'll do this, we'll do that, it still wasn't solving the actual problem, which is sizing at production.
What were you working on before? Your garment technologist? What the hell does that do?
So the best way to describe a garment technologist typically is...
You've been asked this question a lot.
Yeah. So when you see those amazing illustrations from designers, a garment technologist's role is to take that illustration and translate it into a working document that you give to a factory and they're able to produce a physical garment from that document.
Okay.
So it contains the fabric, any trims, any production, like where's there a pocket? Where should the pocket be? How is the pocket sewn? Things like this. So it's like the blueprints of a garment. Now, I wasn't a garment technologist for fashion. I was a garment technologist for PPE. So fire suits, FR and arc protective wear. So highly technical garments where your tech packs had to be perfect.
It's life or death, literally.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
And having visited factories and being on factory floors and seen firsthand, you know, how a fabric can change. I sometimes say that fabric is a bit like water. I mean, you on a hot day, it's liquid. On a cold day, it freezes. And that's a bit like fabric. It can change shape. It's like a fluid material. And as it's going down the production floor, it can completely change and transform.
This is so interesting. This is something I knew so little about. And what was the moment then, it's probably not one moment, but what was kind of like urging you to come up with your own idea, or how did you come up with your own idea?
So this is a story of courage.
Oh, you've set that up lovely.
Because I had spent 2.5 years, and I did not want to say that I was failing. I didn't want to say this idea wasn't it. I did not want to say it. And even though I knew deep down, I didn't want to turn around to myself and say, you're failing at this. You need to change, because if you don't change, it's not going to work out. And when COVID happened, just before COVID happened, I was on a program and I had done a pitch, and the pitch was a disaster. My confidence was at an all-time low. I forgot everything I was going to say. It was the worst pitch I had ever given in my life. And that sparked something in me. My confidence was on the floor. I didn't know if I even wanted to pivot the company. And I took a step back, and COVID happened, and I did step back for a couple of months and trying to build myself back up. And that was something that I really learned about myself, that as much as I wasn't sure if I was going to pivot, I wasn't going to allow myself to just give up, because I knew that there was an issue there, and I knew that I was going to be the one to solve it. No one has ever solved sizing, and I knew that that's why I was put on this earth. It was going to be me. And it was like an annoying little buzz in the back of my head that for months I just, as much as I tried to ignore it, I couldn't. And like all good ideas, I was in the shower one night and I was thinking back over everything that had happened over the past 2.5 years. Me trying to be this, you know, this cookie cutter hustler, entrepreneur. You know, I had worn myself out and I wasn't being my true self, and I had completely lost the joy in everything. Like, I hated it. And I was getting so angry. It was like I was sold a false dream that I told myself. And
well, people do bullshit a lot in the startup world. There is a culture of kind of spoofing and bullshit and fake it till you make it. And there is an element of that, like, that, you know, this is how you do it. You go on these programs and then you get the funding, and then the funding leads to this and you get more funding. And then there's an element of forgetting. Have you a good idea?
Yeah.
Do you like it? You having fun?
Yeah.
It gets knocked out.
Yeah. I was not having fun. I was not enjoying the process. I was.
So you listen to your gut. Like, that's the advice probably people say most on this, is your gut, your gut, your gut. And it's generally entrepreneurs who've been through the mill who go, your gut. But it's often very hard to hear.
How do you train your gut?
Yeah. But is that, you telling me the right thing today? Because you told me something else yesterday, and it's, but I loved how you described it there. It's just that thing in the back of my head that I just couldn't let go. I guess that's it, right?
Yeah.
That's your gut.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was there and I was like washing my hair and I was getting so angry. Angry at what?
Like,
I was
lathering up furiously.
Yeah, I was. I was so angry. I was so angry at everything, at the whole process, at the wasted time. I was angry at myself because I had wasted so much time. And I there and then decided, you're not quitting. You're not giving up on this. You know what you need to do. Like, you were that person on the factory floor. You were creating these garments. You know what you know how to fix this. You've seen a pattern, and you've never heard anyone else mention anything to do with how you solve this.
Yeah.
You know you're onto something. So I got out of the shower, and I had never drafted feature spec or, you know, a roadmap or anything like that. But I spent that whole night drafting a feature spec roadmap. I got to 35 pages
and
I was like, I'm onto something. I downloaded 3 different templates and like molded them into something that I wanted. So I was putting in like, I want this feature. What are the constraints? What are my assumptions? What should the user flow be? What should be expected from this feature? Who's even going to use it? I drafted all of that for every single feature.
That night. Yeah, so you just unlocked, like, this is fascinating though. You just unlocked what was already in you. Like, you knew all this and all the bad advice and all the nonsense about this is how you build a startup. This is what I love doing this podcast. It's conversations like this where you kind of go, this is how actual entrepreneurs do it. Listen to their gut and just go for it.
And that was the best night's sleep I had gotten in years. It was like I got it out onto paper and it was like gone, fast asleep.
That's amazing though. But it shows you the emotional turmoil as well of what it does to you. Mm. It shows you how this like tears you apart. If it is being true to yourself, it's kind of overblown cliche on Instagram a lot, like be true to yourself, listen to your, like, but yeah, that's how it is, right? You just have to in the end, like absolutely. No one's going to build the thing for you. They'll give you all the advice in the world, but no one's going to build it for you. No one's going to tell you that this is the final answer. We're always looking for the silver bullet answer. Yeah. We're always looking for that one thing that unlocks it all. When in reality, it's never that one thing.
Yeah. And being really clear as well with, you know, how you actually want to do this. Because like I said, I had never done that before. I'd never done it for a style wrap. I had loads of assumptions and I wasn't clear. Whereas with this, I finally had a vision. It unlocked something and I finally knew exactly. Like I could visualize where I was going to be. I knew what I wanted out of this. Suddenly, it was like I got my ambition back. I knew exactly where I was going with this, what was happening. And when I started reaching back out to brands that I had previously spoken to and said, this is what I'm building, this is what I'm achieving. And I was on my sixth phone call in a row with brands. And they were the sixth brand to tell me, we want to test this. Mm. And I knew there and then I was like, yep, this is it.
So talk to me about that as well, because I think that's a key insight. And a lot of people do this arse ways to start building without speaking to brands. So you spoke to brands first?
Yes. Before we even started to build, I had my roadmap, I had my feature set, and I started speaking to them about the general idea of what I was doing.
How do you communicate this? Because I always love digging into this part, because I think for entrepreneurs listening, it's really important, because you can be a busy fool for years and blow hundreds of thousands of euro in funding and, you know, hire people and run up against the wall if you don't speak to your customers. It sounds so obvious, but so many people don't. They skip that crucial step.
The difference for me was I read a book. People had been recommending me to read this book for years. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll get to it.
We love a good book recommendation here.
I've loads. But like people had been recommending this book and I kept saying, oh yeah, I'll get to it. But before I went out, I was like, oh shit, I better read this book. And it was The Mom Test.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Yeah. And it blew my mind. It's like you're structuring your questions wrong. You're leading them to tell you what you want to hear instead of getting to the crux of it. You need to understand their pain point and understand, is that pain big enough for them to actually disrupt how they work, their actual workflow, to buy this new tech, to take a chance? Like, are they willing to do all that? Is that pain point meaty enough for them? And you have to be careful about what questions you ask, because you don't want to lead them to the answer that you want. So I read the book and then I reread it and I was like, write everything that makes sense to you and what it sparks in your brain. Like you read something and you get an idea instantly for the type of question that you're going to ask. And I created a list of 24 questions that I knew was what I wanted to ask. But throughout that journey as well, reading that book, it was like, don't ask a question. If you can go into a meeting and not say anything and just let them talk, like don't say anything at all. Try not to even ask one question that you'll get more from it than if you are the one asking the question. And I love to talk. So it was really hard for me to go in and to ask that first spark of a question that would lead them on a journey of talking for 30 minutes without me saying a thing. And it was that really helped, because you could see the relief coming over their faces. You could see the, oh God, like I have this issue. Production came in and I opened the box. And because of my experience, I was able to say, I know that feeling. Like I've been there. I've opened those boxes and I've seen those products and you're like, oh God, what are we going to do? Like production's come in wrong. And that emotive feeling just really came across. And that was just a huge difference for me.
That's incredible. Like, because I collect questions, obviously. But like, the power of a good question is unbelievable. You want the person to talk for as long as possible with the right question.
Yeah.
And not like you said, like nudging them down the road to the answer that you want to get eventually. Cause you can do that. Like, because again, people will kind of generally want to kind of like go, oh yeah, yeah, we do it, that problem kind of, but that's so interesting. So you collected these questions, honed them down, refined them down. And then at what stage did you go, okay, we have it. This is it.
Yeah. Like that, the sixth phone call. And I hadn't asked that many questions. I was like, tell me about your production cycle. Tell me, you know, how do you run your design? What tools do you use? What's your experience with it? What parts of the job do you love? And I wouldn't even say, what parts of the job do you hate? I was specifically asked, what parts do you love? Because I was from industry and I knew all the parts of the job, by getting down to what they love, I instantly knew what they hated. And then I needed to figure out, how badly did they hate those parts of the job? Like, how painful were they for them? And by having those answers, I was then able to draft a response. Okay, you said you hate, like, you love this part. So what we're building isn't for this, it's actually for this. Even though I knew that they didn't mention it, I knew it was a part that they hate. And like, when you mention a certain aspect of the role and they like wince, it's like, yeah, that's painful for them.
It shows you the power of being inside the tent though. You knew the customer, you knew the client, you knew the problem. Like, that's so invaluable. Like,
so someone had said to me, and I never knew this term of deep domain knowledge. And only last year did I actually kind of say, oh yeah, that is actually me.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I had that deep domain knowledge of it. And
it's second nature to you. It's what you've done all your life. So what should you do next? Because I'm always curious to actually bring people along the journey, because that's it. There's definitely someone here listening going, this is me right now. Oh, I'm struggling at this right now. What did you do next then?
So I already had been well networked with a external development company down in Cork, Fiona McKenna. And I reached out to her and I was like, Stellar Rep wasn't working. I told her my whole journey. We had a call where I was just like, oh, I need to get all this out. And she really listened. And Peter Elgar, who was the CEO of Fourth Theorem at the time, like, he had been involved with Nearform and Stitcher Ads. And he jumped on a call with me and was like, I've had a chat with Fiona. I really strongly believe in what you're doing, and we would love to work with you on this. So it wasn't until maybe, you know, 6 months after that we finally actually started to build. And it was a real iterative process. The brands that had agreed to test, I brought them along that whole journey. I gave them updates constantly. Anytime anything was about to be pushed live, I would, you know, reach out to them and go, this is how it's working. Brilliant. How do you like this?
Love that.
And it was like instant feedback. We knew the whole way along if it was working, if it wasn't working. And getting their feedback in it really strengthened what we were building. And then we went out to test in 2022 early. And I knew straight away, like, one of the girls that was a garment technologist started using it and she emailed me, and I actually use it as a quote on my deck now. And it's like, I can never not use this. This is just completely changed.
What a quote.
Yeah. She was like, I love this. This has completely changed my life.
10 out of 10 recommend to a friend.
Yeah.
That's an absolute banger quote from her. God bless her.
And this was an MVP. It wasn't even my fully fleshed vision. And I was like, well, if you love that, wait till you see what I'm going to do next.
I love that though. I want to kind of call that out, because Chris from Trackworks on a few weeks ago, and he talked about this, about like the stake, the bringing people on the journey with you. Like, they pivoted a couple of times, and at every stage, you just brought them along the journey. The customers never talked down to them, just asked them, going, this is what we're thinking about doing. This is where we are. This is what's happening next. And you bring them in. They become stakeholders then, as opposed to kind of customers.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like they have their own skin in the game.
Yeah.
They really want you to succeed. And we got to a stage where they were just so open and honest. They'd be like, this feature is amazing, but like, you really need to change how this is done. And it was like, yeah, you're right. I can see that. Let's do that.
You've outsourced your R&D. Brilliant. That's amazing, though.
And it was. It was so helpful. But even now, when we're speaking to a brand, if there's something that I can sense them, like, mentioning, or, like, straight away, it's added to a list. Everything. Everything is added to a list. And then we look at that list. We look at what is the most requested feature versus what's on our roadmap. Like, which... You don't want to be a fool saying, yeah, we're going to do all of these features straight away. You know, you need to have a roadmap and a plan. But even constantly, I'm not afraid to change that roadmap. If like, we speak to 20 brands and 20 brands have asked for this one thing, we should probably bump it up the list then. You know, if one person asks for it, it's like, yeah, okay, I can see why you need this, but is it as important as this other one? So it's still having them involved, still having the conversations with them. And I love that. That's the one part of the job that I absolutely love. I love getting on a call with them, asking how they're getting on, you know, anything that we can do to help them. And then, you know, what is missing? What do you love about it? What's the parts that you don't love about it? And this time, instead of asking them, you know, what do you love about it? I always ask them, what do you hate about it? What are the parts? Because that's where you get the answer. Because while I know there are certain aspects of the platform that they love, I want to know, where are the blockages? Where can we fix it? Where can we change it? Like, what are the things that we can make better?
So when did you launch it into customers then?
So after the MVP, I took all of the data from the testing, and I started to raise the round. So I started to approach investors, and I laid it out on the table. I said, this is the test data that we have. And
you'd bootstrapped it to this point, had you?
Yeah. So Fourth Theorem had built it. I had, you know, gotten CSF from Enterprise Ireland. I used that money. I won Intertrade Ireland's best new start company in Ireland. So I used that money. I put in my own personal money, and I did not take a wage from August 2020 until May last year. Starting a business is not a get rich quick scheme. So that journey and that process was so difficult and so hard. That's what we had built the tech with. When I went out to investors, you know, gave them all the data from the testing, and I said, this is the vision. This is where we're going to go.
And when you say went out to investors, what does that mean? Like, how do you, I always like to kind of break this down for people who maybe kind of in your position like a couple of years ago. Where do you find investors? Like, where did you find your first set of investors?
So this is a really good question, because I was not someone who had ever started a company before. I was not very well networked. I did not really know very many investors. And someone had given a piece of advice that don't reach out cold. You need a warm intro. And I didn't have warm intros. I didn't know that many people. And I was like, I have to reach out cold. Like, there's nothing that I can do about it. I'm just going to have to. And I know that investors are busy people. So what do? I bullet point it. So I put down 4 bullet points in an email, and I reach out to them. And the 4 bullet points were: the first one, what I'm building. The second one, why I'm building it, my experience. The third one was what I'm going to do with the money. And then the fourth one was my vision for the company overall. Just 4 very quick bullet points.
I love it. I love bullet points.
Yeah.
I love people in general who get to the point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at our attention span. We don't have a very long attention span anymore. People don't like reading big paragraphs. So get to the point. And one of the investors that I reached out to was Amy Neal from Delta Partners. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, seen her speak before, and I really loved what she had said. And I knew that she was, you know, really interested in female founders. So I contacted her through the website. So on Delta Partners website, there's like a calendar, and you can, you know, set up a meeting.
Oh, cool.
So I sent her the 4 bullet points, and they were my lead investor in the end. So that was proof that you can reach out cold to investors.
Everything's about context, though. I think don't spam them. But what you did was just highly targeted. You knew why you wanted to talk to Amy. You had a very clear approach. You knew why it was going to be a fit. It's very different, isn't it, though? Like, there's a very, doing things with style.
Yeah.
I always say that if you just try to do a little bit of style.
Yeah.
A little bit of panache. Dear, insert name.
So someone had said to me, you need to put a process around it. And that kind of is what I ended up doing. Like, everyone that I spoke to, I had researched, do they invest? Like, there was no point in me wasting time reaching out to someone who only invests in medtech. That was never going to be anywhere. So I did look out into people who either had, you know, invested in the fashion or the fashion tech space or retail tech, you know, someone who knew the issue. And our second investor was Hatch, and they were an intro. And when I spoke to Scott, and Scott Weaver's right, is the founder of Hatch. And I was describing the vision for Taylor, and I wasn't even finished describing the vision. And he was like, stop right there. He was like, I felt this pain on two companies that I started. We had products. I was getting them produced in external factories. And oh my God, when they'd come in wrong, he was like, it was painful. He was like, you're telling me you're solving that pain. And I was like, yep. For the textile industry first, but yeah, that's the pain we're solving. And he was like, absolutely get it.
Wow.
So that made it a lot easier. The rest of the call just flowed, and then Hatch did come in as well.
Was it difficult, like, ramping yourself up in terms of knowledge about how to deal with investors, how to raise money, how to ask for money, how to, like, get the money, spend the money? Was that difficult?
So by this stage, because I had been on a few accelerators, because I had been, you know, in this space, and I had been talking to other founders, and it wasn't that I didn't know anything at this stage. I had started to know something.
Okay.
And if I didn't know it, then it didn't bother me because I didn't know it. It was only when an investor would say, do you have a data room set up? And I was like, what's a data room? Yeah.
So it's in progress.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like learning on the job. You know, when you're a founder, you're not expected to know absolutely everything. And as much as I'm a perfectionist and wish I knew absolutely everything, every day is a school day. And you're always constantly learning. And you just have to make sure that the people around you and supporting you have you and your company's best interests at heart. Like, I am a sole founder, but that doesn't mean that I don't have the most amazing team around me advising me if I need help to pick up the phone and ring them. And that's really important, like, having that team. And I know that investors always say your team is important, but it is actually true. Your team are super important.
Do you ever get questioned about being a sole founder? Because you hear mixed signals on this, you hear mixed things.
Before I did, before I had officially went out with Taylor, you know, some investors had said to me, oh, you know, would you bring on a co-founder? And my answer was always the same. And it was like, I'm not against bringing on a co-founder. If I was introduced to the most amazing person ever, and it made sense, then I absolutely would bring them on as a co-founder. But I'm not going to bring someone on as a co-founder just to make you comfortable. And that was what I led with.
I love that answer. Straight to the point.
Yeah, because you always hear of co-founding teams. They have a disagreement. Their vision isn't in alignment. One person's ambition is to be profitable by year two. Another founder's ambition is to be a unicorn.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to get that alignment. You don't have that with a sole founder.
Or they do and then they don't.
Yeah.
Because people change. You know, it's going to be a 10-year thing, really, you know, minimum.
Yeah.
10 years is a long time.
And there's also some very good stats out there from Techstars. When they looked at their portfolio, they found that sole founders outperformed teams. So when I was backed up with that, I was like, well.
Go on then. I love this though, because this is why I love doing the pod as well. It's like, things come into vogue, right? There's these, oh, you have to do it this way. And that was last year. Everyone was like, I'd never invest in a business that didn't have a founding team. And you're like, okay, that was kind of all last year's kind of rhetoric. So I love hearing like the counter argument, because I'm not in that camp. I think there's a million ways to build a startup. I think from chatting to hundreds of founders now, there's no one way.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, oh, what traits do they all share? Certain traits they all share. But there's no one way of building a company. Absolutely not. Depends on exactly what you said at the very start. Everyone's different. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to do it a different way. Maybe it would work with the right co-founder. Maybe it wouldn't. Do you know what interests me though? A lot of founders never have that conversation. I do some teaching in Tangent and Trinity, and that's one of the first things I say to them when they're starting out. It's like, right. And it's so funny, like, talk about like puncturing the atmosphere in the room. They're all like excited. And I'm like, right, first thing you're going to talk about, divorce. They're like, I think your man's lost his rocker. I think he's genuinely fallen off his rocker. It's like, how does this end? Where are you going? What? And I say that exactly. It's like, what does this look like in 3, 5, and 10 years? What do you want? And what do you want? And you can see them sitting beside each other, kind of like eyeballing each other going,
yeah,
I don't know.
What's your exit strategy?
Yeah, because everyone's excited right at the start. Mm. You know, it's cool. You're building something fun. It's amazing though. And I've spoken to founders who are like 3, 4, 5 years in and they've never had that chat. And then it gets awkward because they don't want to bring it up. You know?
Whereas on every single first conversation I've had, so my non-exec chairman is Daniel King. And on our very first conversation, I said to him, this is my vision. This is what I'm building. This is where we're going. And he started laughing and he was like, Jesus, you're not lacking ambition anyway. And I was like, no, but this is it. I can see it. I can see it clearly in my head. This is how it's going to go. And when I brought on my CTO, Magnus, our very first conversation, I told him exactly what we were doing and where we were going. And if you ask him now, what's the vision for the company? It's nearly word for word what I would say. Mm. And everyone knows what the end goal is. We all know where we're going. There might be a different route, but we know where we're going.
We have to have a destination. The journey will change. The road will change. You might take a detour off the Athlone bypass, but you'll get where you're going. But if you never have that end goal in mind, mm-hmm. and that's what happens to so many companies, right? They kind of meander through and kind of hope that luck will strike. And there's, I think, too many kind of like unicorn stories, right? Just too many kind of like, oh, and then 18 months later, they're valued at 500 million. Thankfully, I think companies are now moving back towards more like your standard at the start of like bootstrap, prove the product, then get funding. How much did you raise?
700. Okay.
Okay. Chunky?
Yeah. For a solo female non-tech founder, it was chunky. this, like, people always say to me, how did you do it? And I'm like, I put one step in front of the other.
I asked. Yeah.
I just went through the process.
Had a good idea, weirdly enough.
Yeah, like when I look back now, it was, you know, altogether it's a defining moment. Mm. But looking at the process, it was just putting one foot in front of the other. There was times during the process where I'd go, oh, this is serious. Like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, once you get investors on board, it's a different company. Like, there's board meetings, there's, you know, there's monthly updates. There's so much more to it. It's no longer just you. Are you sure you want it? And the fear side of me would be like, no, let's not do this. But the other side of me that was starting to grow and get stronger was like, absolutely, I want to do this. There's no way in hell I'm stopping now. This is amazing. I'm totally going for this.
This sounds like a big company to build. So I'd imagine you have to do it this way, right?
I mean, we're talking about disrupting an industry completely. It's one of the last industries that kind of can be disrupted. If you look at the fashion industry and the production side of it, if you're on a factory floor and looking around, it is such an analog industry. From the opposite side of it, when someone sees a fashion show or someone sees e-commerce, they're like, this is, you know, a digital native industry. Mm. When you're on the back end of it, that I've experienced, and you see just how analog it is, and it's ripe for disruption, and you know that that disruption is going to be big, then yeah, it is a big company. But just because it's big, that doesn't mean it doesn't come without its issues. It's like, you know, when Apple brought out the first iPhone, and it's like, this is going to house all of this technology that you used to manually carry around before. And it is about finding those first early adopters and those first brands and factories that are really comfortable with such a big disruption, because it literally is moving from Excel. Like, our biggest competitor is Excel. So
really?
It's like moving from Excel to this platform. So it is a big disruptive change.
Where does it sit? Does it sit with the brand and the factory, or does it sit in the factory? How does the platform work?
Sits between them both.
Okay.
So it's like a collaboration between them both.
Okay.
Because it is very disconnected. You will say to a factory, you know, you'll send your tech pack to a factory in India, and what you get back is completely different. And you're like, how did that happen? Like, obviously, how they translated what I had said was completely different. Like, where did that breakdown in communication happen?
Okay. When you say tech pack, what does that mean?
So a tech pack is this document. It's your blueprint document for the garment. So it houses all the information, like your fabric and trims.
But interpretation, then it's open to interpretation on their side. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So it has to be really collaborative between them. And as well with the fabric mill, like that is so disconnected. If you ask a fabric mill what's their biggest issue, it's number one, looking through their inventory and how they can sell that to a brand. But number two, it's the chargebacks from fabric coming in wrong. If you talk to a brand, yeah, their issue is, you know, size-related returns. Another big issue for them is production coming in wrong because the documents were interpreted differently. They will get, you know, production in. It will be amazing. They'll go back to the factory and say, we want to reorder this. But that could be, you know, 2 years later.
Right.
And when they're reordering it, it comes in wrong because the factory interpreted it different again.
Okay. Or the material has changed slightly, or there's been a different process applied.
Yeah.
And when you say come in wrong, what does that mean? Like logistically and money-wise?
So that could be something as small as they ran out of zips. So they went down to the local market and bought a different zip and put it in. It could be something as small as that, or they sewed the lining in wrong. And now when you're wearing it, you know that something is wrong.
Mm,
you can't quite pinpoint what it is, but you know something is twisted somewhere. And it just doesn't feel comfortable. Because it doesn't feel comfortable, you don't like wearing it. And all of these little things, you know, an end user, a shopper, might not consciously think of it, but subconsciously, they're now thinking of your brand as poor quality.
It feels off. Yeah, it is exactly. We were talking about having a coffee in house and why it feels nice in there. And there's certain things, places you get a feel for. We talked about Kilkenny, right? You just get a nice feel there.
Yeah.
It's the same when you're wearing something. You mightn't be able to, because we wouldn't have your skill set. We might be able to say, oh, the cut is off here on the sleeve. But you're feeling, you're like, it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, exactly. And you just feel like something. And you're talking with someone and you're like, oh, I got a gorgeous, you know, trousers, or I got a gorgeous dress, or I got a gorgeous shirt. But it's just, I don't like it. It didn't fit wrong. And now I'm annoyed because it's sitting in my wardrobe.
Yeah.
And do I give it to charity? Do I send it to landfill? Like, you're just annoyed. And it might stop you from going back to that brand again.
And especially when people are trying to be a bit more conscious. Mm. You're trying to be a bit more conscious about what you buy, how often you buy it. You know, I'm trying to buy better quality. I'm trying to buy less, but better. So you don't want to mess that up. Like, you don't want to spend like 70 quid on a t-shirt and you're like, oh, not what I thought it was. The fit is off or whatever, or the style is different. So where do we sit now in 2024 with Taylor?
So where we sit now is that we have the most...
There you go. I was going to say live podcasting, but there's a car horn going off in the background, the car alarm. We're going to get to the story about you in a minute with a different alarms going off. But for now, that's part of the rich experience of doing a podcast.
I love it. So what we're doing now is that our MVP platform, from what it was to where it is now, it is like night and day. I remember someone saying to me that if you're not embarrassed about your first product, you've launched too late. And only 2 weeks ago did I show someone what the Taylor platform used to be. It was amazing. It got us our test data. It got us where we wanted to go. But we're in the fashion industry. You have to be fashion. And when I show brands now that evolution, It's like, wow, like this is amazing. And our platform now is absolutely amazing. It's better than I had even envisioned. And we're at version 1.1. And I'm so excited for this year and where it's going to go, because what we have on the roadmap is just amazing. Like we have gotten an amazing partnership with Adobe. So they're listing us on their plugin page. And that's super exciting for me, because like one of the things that I always hated was saving my drawing. And then, you know, the drawing would be too big, or, you know, how do I send this now? Whereas now you save it. And when you're saving it into your tech pack, you can actually choose the exact area. So you could have on your Illustrator page everything, all the logos and labels, all the drawings. And you can say, right, this part is going to this part and this part is going to this part. And it just saves and creates the tech pack for you. So it's like automated tech packs. And that is really exciting for me. The next part that we're also focusing on is the fabric mills and this fabric intelligence. Like I had said, the fabric mill had sent over their data and processing that. And the interesting thing that we found was that they had the same fabric over and over and over again. And we spoke to them and we were like, did you know that you had the exact same fabric? So we were talking to them about their production process. And if they sell a fabric to Nike, for example, and Nike sell it, and then 3 years later, they go back and they say, we want to reorder that fabric. It's very hard for them to actually find how they had built that fabric before. So they will spend 6 to 8 weeks redeveloping the same fabric again. So the platform that we have built means that it's effectively zero.
They just go back through the files, find your thing, and then amazing.
Yeah, so we're developing that platform out and it is super interesting. It's like rocket science for textiles and I love it.
Textile nerds listening are like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah, it
everyone really else is like, yeah, sounds okay.
Yeah, like even me and Magnus were chatting this morning and we were chatting about the three sides of fabric. Everyone knows two, but there's a third side and we're building the third side.
You're full of great one-liners. I love it. Talk to me about working with Vogue.
Yes. So this was...
This is a story.
Yeah. So to add context, I had set myself some New Year's resolutions at the start of 2023. I knew that it was going to be a big year for me and it was going to be a big year for Taylor. And one of the resolutions that I had set myself was to do more public speaking. I had not done much. I was not comfortable doing it. I was not confident in doing it. One of the last times that I had done public speaking was an absolute disaster of a pitch. So I knew that it was a skill that I needed to learn and stretch and mold myself
into. I think in the year you've come on quite a bit.
So the resolution was you have to say yes to any speaking opportunities that come your way. And my goal was 4, because that was as big as I saw it. I was like, 4 is big enough. I had done 4 by March. And it was like, once I'd opened myself up, the opportunities came and they just kept coming.
It's true. So, though, I'm a big goals nerd. And I believe once you set them, you're more likely to see them. Yeah. As in suddenly you're like, oh, I could actually say yes to that. And you don't overthink things. I find when I set goals and they're very specific about it, you know, I have a numerical goal, like, oh, I want to do 12 by the end of the year. Suddenly you just go, yeah, I'll do that. You say yes straight away. Whereas otherwise you kind of think about it and then talk yourself out of it. So I love this process. So you set 6 personal and 6 business.
Yes, I did. 6 personal and 6 business. Like a personal one was to read 12 books. I ended up reading 24. So it was...
23 is a big year.
It was a big, busy year. So when I had reached that fourth speaking event, it was like something in my brain had just went, okay, you've reached 4 now. And it meant that everything was up in the ether. You know, there was more possibilities. I could feel the magic in the air. It was like glitter. I knew something big was coming, but I didn't worry about it. I didn't stress about it because I'd actually reached the goal. The pressure was off me. It was like, there's no more pressure. If something big comes, it comes. Never in my wildest dream would I have imagined that Vogue would ask me to speak about AI in the industry. And it was about AI and the future of the industry. So when the opportunity came, I thought it was a scam. I was like, yeah, sure, you're from Vogue.
It is a bit outlandish, to be fair. I can see how you think that.
And they were like, no, really? I was like, yeah, whatever. But no, it really was. But it was being held in Ukraine. Ukraine, as we know, is currently a war zone with the Russian invasion. So when I got the opportunity, it was, you don't say no to Vogue. But also, are you willing to do anything for this company? And my answer to myself was, hell yeah, I am. I'm willing to do this.
I love this story so much.
And I said it to my partner and he was like, you're not going to Ukraine. And I was like, watch me. So there was certain family members we couldn't say anything to because they would worry. So I told my family, we're not going to say anything to my nanny. She's not to know. I will be posting stuff. I do have to tell you that I will be there, but you are not to tell her. So
blocking her on Instagram.
Yeah, well, she's not on Instagram anyway. So it did mean that I had to travel 33 hours to get to Kiev. So it was a flight to Poland, and then it was a train to Lviv. And then from Lviv to Kiev, it was a 13-hour train journey in a shared cabin with people that I'd never met before. I didn't know who was going to be in the cabin with me. It was noisy as well. So it was an experience and a half.
I love that though. That's the founder attitude right there. Say yes, no matter what. But what an opportunity and a story. And you know what? It's amazing to do something like that too, to bring some sort of normality to somewhere like that during an incredibly tough time.
The stories that I heard of resilience. There was a brand that Vogue brought me to meet. And I got to see their manufacturing, their production. You know, I really got to sit down with the founder and hear his story. If you go on, the brand is Frolove. If you go on to their Instagram, you will see Beyonce on her world tour wearing one of their dresses.
Wow.
You will see J-Lo in her new film that she's releasing, that famous white wedding dress with the heart cutouts. They made that. She recently was singing on stage with a white shirt. They made that. Like, they are being worn by these huge celebrities. When I asked, you know, what does that mean? He was like, so humble. And he was like, yeah, that's amazing. And then he told me this story. And I was like, wow, like other startups think that they have problems. Like, this is insane. So they had gotten the order from Beyonce's team. And with the rolling blackouts, there was a rolling blackout.
Oh, my Lord.
There was no way that they could sew. So it was him and his team sitting on the floor under candlelight, hand stitching that dress. And then trying to logistically get it out of the country. And hearing that story was insane to me. I was like, how do you conduct business in a war zone? And those resilience stories were just amazing. And then another brand that they had also introduced me to and brought me to was The Coat. And hearing their story of, we're building this so that when the war is over, we're ready.
Oh, I love
we're
that.
We're ready for the world when this, like, we're doing all the groundwork now.
That's amazing. What an attitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, what a story. And just kind of digesting that story as you tell me. That's incredible. So, like, what was the experience then of speaking like? What was it like speaking at the conference?
Oh, I was so nervous.
Even after everything, like.
Oh, yeah. Like, I was so, so super nervous. There was this really cool piece of technology where, because it was in Ukraine and there was, you know, a lot of Ukrainian brands there. So they had a translator at the back of the room and everyone was wearing earpieces. So as I was speaking,
they look amazing.
Yeah. So as I was speaking, they were hearing what I was saying in Ukrainian. And it was amazing because at the end, when it was like, does anyone have any questions? There was loads of questions because they knew what I had said and they knew what I was talking about. And yeah, it was. It was really cool actually to see that. But yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was so nervous. So, so super nervous. I still get nervous. Like, I'm not a natural extrovert. I know that I have to be for the company. So I still get nervous pushing myself out there, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to do it. I'm still going to do it. I just, you know, I can be uncomfortable, but I'm still going to do it.
We talked about this over coffee about like the importance of building a brand, important to building a personal brand as well. Like that's, I think it's such a massive unlock for founders, especially in Ireland, that need to start tapping into the power of your own brand, because people buy from people.
Yeah.
You know, and a company with a strong founder story is immensely powerful. Like Elon is the one example everyone uses. It's a bit cliche now, but like Tesla would just be another electric car brand without that story. You know, love him or hate him, you know, personal stories matter in business. And I think personal branding, it's kind of a wanky term, but I think it's going to come back massively, especially when people realize that marketing is very, very challenging. And the biggest thing a startup has is their founder. It has the story of like how they built the business. That is sometimes it's all you have at the start.
It, you know, it's so important. And I realized really quickly just how important it was going to be, especially for the industry that I'm in. Brand is everything. Like there's billion-dollar companies. Like look at Hermes. Their brand is everything. Yeah. I mean, they posted in the last quarter, their revenue was $3.9 billion last year, in the last quarter alone, and it's up again. But their brand surpasses them. And that's the industry that I'm in, where your brand means everything. So I knew very quickly that in order for us to make a big impact, we had to be that brand. We had to build that brand. We had to be seen as the fashion tech brand. So that's what we had to build. And, you know, you have to be a part of that. You can't be a nameless or a faceless tech. You have to be that picture, you know?
And it's really boring. Someone pitched me today, dropped me a mail. Oh, you have to talk to this person. I clicked in. I was like, that looks immensely boring. There was nothing to it. It was like a tech company doing, I won't name any names, but it was just really boring. Nothing really about the founder. Founded, started this. We're working on this. That was it. Like, how is anyone going to bring you on a podcast that's an hour long when you haven't even taken the time to build out some sort of narrative or story around yourself? I get pitched people all the time and they've done nothing. They've never done any, the smallest thing, might even have a headshot, you know, and you're kind of going,
I have a really good story on headshots.
Hit me. I'm loading up our quickfire round as you talk.
So people come to me even now and they say, God, your images are, you know, they're very glam. And I don't know if they mean it in a good way or a bad way.
Irish is very glam. It's just a very Irish thing, isn't it? Very glam.
I'm going to take it as a good way. But I knew that I had to stand out. And when you typically see startup companies that have raised around, you know, they're outside the building with the arms crossed. Oh, and I was like,
oh, you're triggering me now. You're going to start my hobby horse. Go on.
And I knew that wasn't us. That was never us. So we had a full photo shoot, like a full editorial photo shoot with different outfits and everything. And I was petrified the whole day. Like they kept having to say to me, smile. I was so scared. I wasn't even smiling.
Really?
I was so nervous. And at the end of the photo shoot, when I saw the images, and then when the images were, you know, like in the Business Post or in the Irish Independent, and it really brought Taylor to life. You could tell instantly. Like you could tell instantly they're in fashion. Like they're doing something with fashion.
But you can tell you care. You care. I don't hate many things. I hate the photos where founders have raised, or there's an initiative, they're holding up the foam sign. That's one of the things I hate most in the world, where you see those press calls and they're holding up the foam sign. You're like, you've just raised 5 million and they're in generally a blazer.
Yeah.
And it's probably down Grand Canal, standing on the edge, holding the foam sign. And you're like, you've raised 5 million and you couldn't spend $2,000 coming up with a cool photo shoot.
Yeah.
Like I always look at it, Wired magazine. It's gone downhill a lot, but just the photos in it and how products are displayed and how founders are photographed and how they photograph really interesting things, because they take time and they care and they might spend a week doing a photo shoot. That matters.
Yeah. And the brands that I want to sell to, they're used to looking at fashion editorials. Yeah. If I had one of those images of just us outside the building, it doesn't align with what they know about the industry. If I wanted to align
pattern recognition.
Yeah. If If I wanted them to see us as genuine fashion tech, it had to be that way. It had to be similar to a fashion editorial because it's recognizable. It's comfortable to them.
I love that. So if anyone's listening wants a good business idea, photography studio that specializes in Wired and Vogue style photo shoots for founders.
Absolutely.
Niche, but niche is work. Shauna, we're going to do a quick fire round. You teased this earlier. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
Okay, so I already said The Mom Test, so I'm going to go a different one. 0 to 1.
I love that. I really like Peter Thiel's book. Yeah. Yeah,
it was so exciting for me because it was then that I realized that Taylor is a 0 to 1 company. I didn't have the words or the vocabulary around it. And after reading that book, I was like, we are a 0 to 1 company. And it just filled me with more confidence. It's rare that I read a book and at the end of it, I actually feel confident. And that's what that book did for me. I actually felt confident.
He's a quirky character, but some of his thinking is, you mightn't agree with it all, but my God, a big thinker. It's a brilliant book. Actually, you must reread that. It's so good. What's the biggest thing you've learned about yourself since starting the business?
What is the biggest thing that I've learned? That is interesting. So I feel like the biggest thing that I've learned is that I'm not a quitter. That if you had asked me 4 years ago, was I a resilient person? Was I a strong person? I probably would have said, yeah, but not really believed it. But having gone through everything that I've gone through over the past few years, I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely resilient. I am not a quitter and I will always make sure that it works out in the end.
And you can point to it. You can kind of look at, this is when I wasn't a quitter, this exact moment.
Yeah.
I love that. What valuable business is no one currently building?
Another good question. This is a tough one because I think there's so many businesses out there that sometimes when you hear it, it's like there's five other people doing that exact same thing as well. And then someone will always come out with a business and I'm like, Jesus, I never thought of that. Mm. I wish I could think of that. And so it's hard to pinpoint that, but I think it's something that we spoke about earlier, and that is moving governments or banks off Wet Ink.
Wet Ink.
There's so many different solutions out there and they're still using Wet Ink, which means they're not comfortable with moving over to digital signatures. So a great company that hasn't been built yet is something secure enough for governments or banks to finally get rid of Wet Ink.
You even got the name, Wet Ink. What would you do today if I give you 10 million? I'm going to caveat that and say, Taylor's fully funded. You don't need it for the business.
I definitely would invest. There has been so many great companies that if I had money, I would invest in them in an absolute heartbeat. Absolute heartbeat.
Don't keep it a secret. You can shout them out.
I won't because there's too many to name. And
oh,
if I forget
you just pick
one,
favorites. Oh,
yeah,
come
and if
on.
If I forget one, I wouldn't like to
You're going to get splinters on that fence.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to do it. But there is some amazing great companies. And I do have to say that I have actually started to do some small angel investing. So I have, like, you know, on platforms like Crowdcube, where there's a low buy-in, it can really, you know, help you get on the investment ladder. And you asked me a question earlier about how do you know the investment process? The easiest way to learn the investment process is to actually do it. So I registered on Crowdcube. I very quickly learned what the different terms meant. You know, what was in typical shareholders agreements, what was in all the terms and conditions, what was, you know, the different share structures, what was the equity split like?
This is so interesting.
And that is how I learned. When an investor was talking, I was like, oh yeah, I know what that means now. There were still things that I didn't understand, I didn't learn. And having a good lawyer is paramount. And I did have the best. Shout out to Taylor Wessing. But it was definitely, you know, being on platforms like Crowdcube and going through, like, it's not mad money. Like, the minimum buy-in is one share. So It's very easy and quick to do it, and you really understand and learn.
What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
Negative speak. Everyone speaks negatively to themselves in their head and they don't realize it. And when you finally realize
it... You wish you started negatively speaking to yourself more?
No, stopping it. So actually realizing what I just said to myself is negative.
Mm.
And for every positive thing that you say to yourself, you say like four negative. And throughout a day, that really adds up and it does affect your subconscious. You don't even realize it. Like you wear yourself down, and there's so many people in the world that are willing to tear you down. Don't be another person tearing yourself down, because you need to build yourself up. So learning to actually realize that I was speaking negatively to myself was so, so hard, because how do you even know that?
I didn't even realize. I never knew this until 2020.
Yeah.
I started working with a performance coach, Shane Craddock, and started talking about the inner voice. And I was like, yeah, I guess I do. But you just think that's your brain. But then you think, what am I actually saying? And it's, I kind of equated it to, well, you never speak to someone else like you speak to yourself.
So I worked with a performance coach called Poppy Delbridge. Poppy's in the UK.
Incredible name.
Yeah, absolutely. So she had been a high exec at Warner Brothers.
Oh, cool.
And she had said to me that exactly the same thing. You don't talk to yourself. And we were in a group, and she forced every single one of us to write a list of all the negative things that we say to each other. And when we had the list, we went back on the call, and she forced us to say the list to someone else. Mm. And let me tell
That's
you,
brilliant.
That absolutely changed me. I felt awful saying some of the things that I'd said to myself. Like saying it to myself didn't make me feel bad. Having to look someone in the eyes and say it to them was such a change for
That's
me.
That's great exercise.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that.
It was tough. It was really tough.
Tough.
Like we all felt awful. Like we were literally saying things and then going, I really don't mean it. I'm so sorry.
But you're saying that to yourself 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day. That sounds outrageous, but it isn't, because you're with yourself 24/7. Okay, you're asleep for eight of them.
And like everyone does it. You drop something and you're like, oh, you're such an idiot.
Yeah.
Like even small things like that. You keep telling yourself you're an idiot enough, and you eventually start believing it.
Without a doubt. That's really interesting. I love that answer. I'm going to give you 1 million. I'm going to put you on the spot here now. No wishy-washy answers. I'm going to give you 1 million. You have to invest in one company or one person. Who is it?
Me? You didn't.
I didn't caveat that one enough.
No. I honestly, like I...
And you know what? I like that answer, because I like when founders back themselves, and a lot of founders say it, and I always enjoy when they say it. So I'm going to let you away with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. All day, every day. If I was to win the lotto in the morning, I would take it all and put it into Taylor.
That's probably a tricky question now coming up. If you just started a new company in the morning, what would it be?
So I actually have. I have a little notebook of all these business ideas that come to me. Some of them are crazy. I literally try to fall asleep at night and I have these random ideas pop into my head. So the next would be for the home sewing industry.
That it? That all we're getting?
That's it. I'm not giving away my secret sauce.
I'll pencil you in next year for that one. What do you believe that other people will strongly disagree with or find strange?
You need to buy less clothing. Like the world is just being overproduced at the minute. Look at when it was back in the 60s. You'd go in and you'd buy a garment and it would be fitted perfectly. Mm. There's people going in now buying garments and they just don't sit well. And we're losing that skill. You go on Savile Row now and there's just not as many tailors as there used to be.
I read that in the Financial Times. They did a really interesting, I love their long reads at the weekend, and they did a big expose about how there was so few and there's very few people getting into it, and it's getting so expensive that they can't afford to set up there anymore.
And even the bespoke work that's coming out is sometimes not actually bespoke. There's parts of it that were machine sewn, or they've cut corners.
They're making bits of it. It's probably costing as well, right?
To find someone that can do a full bespoke suit the way they used to do it like 30 years ago, it's so hard. And it kills me inside that we're losing that skill. So I'm a big outspoken proponent for you know, the craftsmanship of the industry that we're starting to lose. And I wish that we could get back to that. Like the craftsmanship of different parts of India with their bespoke embroidery work that is stunning. Like there's a fabric that used to be made in India and it was made from reeds from a certain lake, only in one part. And we no longer know how to make that fabric.
Oh, wow.
There's pleated fabric, fortuny pleats. And there used to be dresses that would be made out of these pleats, teeny tiny pleats. We don't know how to make them. We can't make them. So we're losing all of these skills. And to see it happening before your eyes, I hate that about the industry.
What's something in your daily life you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
Fashion.
Ironically.
So to counteract my last point about we should buy less clothes, I'm one of those people. And it's everything. I mean, I collect, I have my own personal archive that I've started collecting from vintage designers. I love a Mugler piece. So my personal archive, I
think that's kind of different though, because you're collecting it for a reason.
Yeah, you might think that.
I'm giving it out there.
Yeah. No.
You're not a hoarder, you're a collector.
Yeah.
Everything's how you frame it.
Who has a dehumidifier in the room for the clothes?
I respect deep domain knowledge. You just know what we don't.
It gives me immense happiness to sit in that room.
Get a great insight into your mind. What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur listening?
My final piece of advice is definitely, you know, this is a hard road. It is a really hard road, and success is not a destination. It's the journey. And it's really important to have that final vision. And it really is, you know, you have to know where you're going to go, but don't throw yourself into it so much that you really just, there's no joy in your life. Because I had done that. I mean, even now, if you say to me, when was the last time you saw your friends? When was the last time you saw your family? And it, like, I do it myself. I put myself so much into it that sometimes I have to kind of go, oh, I need to bring some joy back into my life a little bit right now. Mm. You know, I need to go see my friends. And, you know, success is the actual journey. You need to enjoy that journey. So do things that make you feel that joy. If that means that, you know, you have your calls and at 10 o'clock you get out and you go for a walk, do it. Give yourself that time. Whatever you feel is joy for you, just do it, because that's the good part about starting a company, is that you are your own boss. Yeah. And you can do these things. Remember that, you know, bring that joy in and give yourself those headspace moments and that joy.
Beautiful. Shauna, where can people learn more about yourself and Taylor?
We're everywhere. So follow me or Taylor on Instagram.
What are the handles?
So Shauna Chu. Even if you just Google me, we actually come up. I have a pretty unique name. So just Google my name, we come up. And Taylor is T-A-I-L-R. So we're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. I am trying to start TikTok. So, you know, come see us there too.
Perfect. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.